Because it asks for a better day to set aside and do statistics stuff. Okay, so I'll try to make this as painless as I can. But the first point really is statistics is really important to you personally in ways that many of you may not have really thought about very much. So, can you read that? Didn't write down the source, sorry about that. This was from a few years ago when George Bush, the younger, ran against Al Gore. And in the run-up to that election, there was an Ohio paper that ran this, the Ohio poll, and Bush leads overall head-to-head races. And look at this for a moment. So they make a strong point about it. A long time before that, and I don't have the graphic for it, actually it was on television, I remember sort of noting the numbers way, way, way back when. You may not,
you don't remember it at all,
but Bush the Elder ran against a guy named Dukakis way back when, 1988. And at that time, there was this big deal, it was a headline in the national news on the, you know, CBS or whatever it was, I don't actually remember which network it was, but it was a major network. Dukakis surges past Bush in polls. And the numbers were sort of something like this. Last month, Bush was ahead 42-40%, and this month, we've got Dukakis ahead 43-41%. And then their little graphic off to the side, they show that the error in the poll is ±4%. Now, what do you make of that? And what fraction of the public do you think noticed or cared or understood what that meant? I mean, let's be a little bit cynical. Either we have complete idiots in charge of this network, or worse, they deliberately put it up there because they have no agenda. Right? Hard to see. This is more recent, Bush leads overall at the head races. If you look at this, Bush has 47, Gore 41 here, Bush 49, Gore 45 here, and it says very clearly that the margin of error is 4.2 percentage points. What that margin of error means is that if you just ask some other sample of people, these numbers could vary by about 5%. This is a dead heat. Okay, the other one was a dead heat. They have not done a measurement that can distinguish what the headline claims that they've got. So that's politics, and if you watch political polls, you'll see this kind of crap going on every year. But it's a lot more than that. There's statistics all around us, and it's flagrantly misused. 95% fat-free. That means it's 5% fat. Think about that. So there are lots of things that are happening these days. There's lots of arguments about global warming. A lot of that boils down to statistical analyses. The implications of what you come out of that can be dramatic. You can make certain cuts on your data and basically come up with whatever answer you want if you have an agenda. So you have to be very skeptical about a lot of what you hear. Many
of you may end up being involved with analytical medical diagnostics of various sorts. So you get a number. Is it significant or not? Right? So the significant change, or is it within sort of what normally bounces around during the day? So there's an error on the measurement that's inherent both to the instrument or to what varies with the body on a normal day. Right? And you're going to have to be aware of what the variations are to make any sense of what kind of numbers you're seeing. I can't tell you the number of times that I see articles on the fact that cell phones cause brain damage, stuff like that. Okay? So people do epidemiological studies, and the truth is, if you plot enough variables against enough variables, you're going to find sometimes you get a peak. It's just going to happen. There's not actually a physical way for this to happen. The frequency of the light from cell phone, the frequency of the electromagnetic radiation that is used for cell phones does not, the photons don't have enough energy to actually ionize anything. So they can't, it's not ionizing radiation. So we know of no mechanism whereby this can actually create cancer. But these are very real, and if you were to believe that this is really true, and you start to make, we live in an electromagnetic design, okay? So, by the way, if you ever look on the late night ads or whatever, and you buy one of these little discs that you're supposed to put on your cell phone to protect your head from getting radiation, just send me the money instead. Because that radiation is sort of going all over the place, and it's not going to do anything. Even if it did cause cancer, it's not keeping any radiation from blasting your head. So, but it is giving somebody a lot of money. Anyway, so error analysis is more than just numbers. Although we're going to try to do as much with numbers as we can sort of in physics. So, you know, what kinds of things can you measure quantitatively? Lots of things. Distances, masses, times, oxygen fraction in the blood, etc. Right? Qualitatively is also a very powerful thing, right? You know, your pee looks yellow. I don't know how yellow is yellow. Is it bad or is it good? You see, sort of see blood. And then you can do qualitative measurements with instruments. You can actually look at colors and things like that. But this kind of thing is very important. There's a lot of judgment call in what you think about things, and there's a lot of error in that. Even in science, there's a lot of art involved in science, and sometimes the hardest errors to put on something when you want to make a claim and write a paper have to do with the things that are a little qualitative and places where you're going a little bit on gut instinct, and sometimes that's a little hard to quantify. Anyway, sorry, I wrote these slides a long time ago, and I had just discovered how to do animations. So it's like animated out the wazoo. Sorry, I should have killed those. So it turns out quantitative measurements, right, where you're actually putting a number on something, and qualitative measurements where you try to do that insofar as you can, but sometimes you can't do it so well, are both very important in science, okay? Even in hard science and physics and stuff. But we do try to be as quantitative as possible with most of this. And in your labs, I think most of the time you'll be fairly quantitative. So a lot of what sets physics apart from some of the other sciences is we try very hard to simplify a system insofar as we can so that we can get at the essence of what's going on and understand it quantitatively, if at all possible. This is hard to do for many of the other sciences because often you're actually studying things that have multiple properties, so it's not like you can simplify a dog to the simplest state, really, and
understand more about it. You've got to have a dog. And we've talked about, I guess I told you the story of my son, where he's going around with this little tape measure. And actually, I think I got the number wrong. I think he's going 2.5 or anything. And I asked him, 2.5 what? He just looked at it like, what are you talking about? But the truth is that when you make measurements, we've talked a little bit about the fact that if you measure something, you have to have a unit. If you're measuring that thing, if you don't get the unit, then you're not. What kind of measurements? What's the number? But in addition, although we won't worry about it for the problem sets that you do, but in the labs you have to worry about it, and in the real world you have to worry about it. If you make a measurement and you record it, it is completely worthless if you do not also give a measure of how good that measurement is. You have to record it with an error. Okay? So you need units and error. All right, so talk about a few things just to get things rolling. In common everyday usage, many of us will sort of use the word accurate or the word precise interchangeably, but they actually really mean different things. When you say something is accurate, it's really a measure of how close something is to the truth. And I put this in quotes because you may not really know exactly what the truth is. So sometimes knowing how accurate something is a little bit hard to know. Precision really is a measure of the reproducibility of the measurement. It can be flat out wrong, but so long as it is wrong in the same way every time, you might have a very precise measurement. And then you repeat it and it doesn't scatter very much. Okay. So these are really very different things. Just to drive that point home, let's suppose that we have, we're plotting something against something else, we're making some measurement, and let's say the truth sort of lies at the center of the circle, and we make measurements. And here they're all clustered together, but far from the center. So this would be something that is not very accurate because it's far from the center, but it is very precise because they don't scatter very much. So the second one, there's a lot of scatter, and they're not very far from the center, so it's neither accurate nor precise. The third one is both accurate and precise because you're near the center and they're clustered close together. And the fourth one, it's accurate, even though there's a lot of spread. On average, you're getting the right answer. So, all right. So we generally talk about lots of types of errors, and the easiest error to handle generally are the statistical errors. And statistical errors really result from a random fluctuation in the process of a measurement. And generally, you might even attribute, let me come back to this for a second. So, usually you can repeat the measurement again and again, and from the scattering results you can get a good estimate of what the statistical error is. So, it tends to cause scatter in whatever it is you're measuring. But if you haven't changed anything fundamental, it's not going to shift the value all that much, generally. So usually this just makes you a little less precise. The other type of error that we generally have to deal with are known as systematic errors. And systematic errors result from sort of just a bias that you may have, which might be there because of observing conditions or the apparatus or the technique or the analysis. And they tend to make the measurements less accurate. So imagine that I want to measure the length of this table, okay? And I can put a yardstick on this thing, and in order to measure it, I put my eye up here, above sort of the edge, and I look to see what black mark on the yardstick is closest to, and I make some estimate of what that is. Now, unless I go to a lot of trouble, sometimes my head will be a little bit this way, sometimes it will be a little bit that way, and so I will actually measure slightly different numbers every time I measure it. And you might argue that this is sort of a systematic bias in the sense that it is caused by something that in principle you could understand and fix. But it manifests itself as something that sort of scatters around. And it actually would sort of show up as sort of a statistical fluctuation in this thing. Okay? If I happen to... have the yardstick not flush up to this side, but maybe, you know, a quarter inch in because I just made a mistake. Now I'll make a bunch of measurements and they'll all be off by a quarter of an inch. That's a systematic error. Okay. So I have another systematic error, which might be if I did it on a really cold day, this thing may have shrunk a tiny bit relative to what it is on a very hot day. So if you went and you measured the length of the table with great precision again and again and again through the course of the year as the temperature changes, you'd actually find an annual variation basically on average, because when it's colder it'll be shorter than it is when it's hot. So systematic errors sometimes can in principle be overcome, and you may choose not to do it because you can't afford the time, the energy or the money or whatever it takes to do it. Or you may really not know what the source of the problem is, but you know that there's something that you can't quite get right. And so you absorb that in what's known as the systematic error. The statistical error really sometimes you might be able to do a little something about it, such as my head motion I could fix, right? I could basically put a piece of metal that's up here and always jut my head up against it, so I'd sort of take that source of the error. So sometimes you can fix it a little bit, but in the end, measurements will always vary a little bit, and so you sort of, if you make a measurement that involves a lot of things that you count, for example, those things will be a little bit different depending on what set of things you get. And that's sort of incorporated in the statistical error. And it's basically irreducible. So we'll see a little bit why that is in a minute. You can reduce it by making more and more measurements and basically averaging the problem. But there comes a point of limited return that we'll talk about. So, any questions so far? All right. Okay, so let's suppose that we make a whole bunch of measurements, and maybe let's say some stupid measurement, like we sit off to the side of the road and we measure, we start a stopwatch when a stoplight turns green. And we stop it when it flashes yellow. So we're basically measuring the amount of time that this stoplight is green. Okay? And we're going to get some variation in those numbers because we're not perfect with the stopwatch. Maybe there's not even perfection in the electronics that's driving the timer. But you'll end up with some scatter. Okay? So let's say that we make 100 measurements, and this basically tells you how many times you measured something within a time here. This number is how many times you measured this time. This is how many times you measured that time, etc. So you get some distribution. And this is not at all unusual for measuring things. And let's say that in this particular world, we're going to say that this is the true value. You may say, how do you know that? And really, you don't. But we're going to pretend for a moment that God speaks to us and says, this life has... We'll say that this is the true value for the moment. And If we were to take thousands and thousands and thousands of measurements, and if we had no systematic bias in this thing, in fact, we would get a smooth distribution that looks something like this. And that's what we call the parent distribution. Okay. We never can really do an infinite number of measurements, so it's a bit of a theoretical construct, but we sort of hypothesize that that exists. And I'm gonna call this true value, simplicity here later on in some of the equations, we're just gonna call that mu for the moment. And so the trick is, if you go out and you make a bunch of measurements, what you would really like to get is a determination of this as best you can. But that's the whole idea. But the problem is that you, and maybe you can even see that if you could make an infinite number of measurements, you'd get this very smooth distribution, and you might argue that the mean here would be your true value. But the problem is you're not told the truth. So the real trick in the measurements, you actually want to make a finite number of measurements, observations, and you want to determine this truth and how well you know this truth as best you can. Okay? So that's what you'd like to do. But the problem is you don't actually know the truth, so you have to estimate it from your data as best you can. So I need to use a few words as we go along, so let's do this. I think your intuition works best if you sort of think of the error that you see in some measurement that you make as described by the parent distribution of the Gaussian. So this would be what you'd end up with the stopwatch, for example, or with my head moving around a little bit, the length is a little short sometimes, a little long sometimes. So you'd end up with some scatter around the true value. And I'm going to mainly give you an intuition that works for this kind of picture. But not everything has this. Sometimes there are inherent things that push you in one direction or the other. So what we saw a moment ago is something basically called Gaussian distribution. It is a form of a Poisson distribution, but this would be a Poisson distribution. And so this parent distribution of how the measurements, the observations may vary, may actually not always be Gaussian. So you need to be a little bit careful and don't assume everything is Gaussian. Let's suppose that we have measured something, okay, some quantity x. This is the parent distribution. So what this means is that most often we measure an x value that's here, right? And sometimes way out here, sometimes over here. So you make an infinite number of measurements and you plot it out and you get something like this. So the most probable value is that one which is right at the peak. Okay? So if you were to make a single measurement, if you were a betting person, that's where you'd put your money. The median of the distribution has 50% of the measurements below it and 50% above it. The mean or the average value of x, you know how to calculate an average. So in this case, it gets pulled over here because these values of x go out there to very high values. So even though you don't have many of them over here, in the average, they count for a lot. So they pull you this way. Okay. So when you have a distribution that's not Gaussian, the median and the mean are actually different. But if you have a Gaussian distribution, all of these just lie right on top of each other. Okay? And I would say this is sort of the most common thing that you're going to see, and it's basically where I want you to develop your intuition. So, in this case, the most probable value, the median, and the mean are all the same number. Okay. All right. So,
now let's suppose we have a finite number of measurements, in observations, okay? And I just lay on top of that, God talks to us, so we draw this parent distribution in the true value. And remember, the game is we want to take these in observations, and from those figure out mu and how well we know mu as best we can.
So, if you have a big systematic bias in whatever it is that you're measuring,
your distribution here is going to be far away from the truth. And basically, you can't, from your data, infer the right value. You have to improve it in the experiment. You have to figure out what that systematic effect is. And sometimes it's hard to track down. And there are many instances where many different groups have measured something and they've all basically been wrong. And then somebody will discover something, you'll see the whole value shift well outside of the error bar. And so let's ignore the systematic effect for a moment. But if you have some set of n measurements, the best estimate that you have for the true value is the average of these measurements. So you basically take this whole bunch and you average them, right? So you take these different x's and you divide by the total number. Now, we also would like to determine how well we know mu. And what I showed you a moment ago was a set of measurements that's fairly broad.
Boy, this thing's not going backwards, no.
Right, so we have a fairly broad measurement. And the average is our best value of x. But if our measurements were sort of closer together, you might think, okay, now if I average it, I should know it better because most of my measurements are in close to that value. So you could imagine that the scatter in your measurements here gives you some idea of how well you actually know this true value that you're trying to get at. Okay? So one might construct the error in this to go like the difference between each of these measurements and the true value, if you could do that. Okay? But the problem, and so given that you make a whole bunch of measurements, a measure of how broad this distribution is sort of given by a sum of each of these differences, if you will. But if you look at it, this doesn't work very well because it will basically give you an error of zero. Because measurements over here, mu is bigger than that, so it has a positive sign. Measurements over here are bigger than mu, so you have a negative sign. And when you add those things together, they largely cancel out. So this really doesn't end up giving you a nice measure of the width of this thing.
But if you square it, if we square that, then whether you deviate to this side or that side, you have a positive quantity. So you can add the differences squared.
So the way in which we quantify how well we know that quantity is by what's called the standard deviation, where what I do is I take the sum of the squares of each measurement from this simple point. Okay, so that they're all positive, so that they all add, and then I divide it by the total number, because I sort of want an average deviation, if you want to think about it that way. And then I take the square root here to basically get rid of that square. And so this now is a measure of the width of this distribution. You okay with that?
So we call this the standard deviation.
Generally, though, when you calculate it, this isn't the form that you use. And the reason that you don't use it is because unless God talks to you, you don't know what mu is. Right? So you have to use your estimate of mu. And the estimate that you use is your best estimate, which is just simply the average of all the measurements. So instead of mu, you put in the average of all the measurements here. And you calculate the same thing. But the problem is that you've now used a little bit of information. So you need to make this error a little bit bigger to basically show that. And so the way to do that is to reduce this number here by 1. So that makes the overall error here a little bit better, a little bit bigger. So this is actually the form of the standard deviation that you use when you are making measurements and you're calculating how well you know what you know. Okay?
Alright. So we're talking about the Gaussian distribution,
which mathematically is given by this. If you were to draw some Gaussian and describe it mathematically, you would have some constant. And this is an exponential that depends on this x minus x bar. Okay. It also depends on the sigma. So the sigma basically is a measure of the width of this thing a little bit. So mathematically, it comes right in. If I make sigma really big, this thing's going to spread way out.
So mathematically, that's what it is. Intuitively, here's what I'd like you to really know about
sigmas and errors.
If you make a bunch of measurements and you get some distribution that's roughly Gaussian and looks a bit like this, if you more or less take half width at half max, so that is, you go half the height of this thing, and you go half the width, then this will end up being approximately one sigma. So that's a rule of thumb you can use when you sort of see something graphed out, okay? And what that really means, if you've never thought about it, is that for a Gaussian error, the intuition that I'd like you to have is that if you make a measurement, a single measurement, it has almost a 70% probability of falling within plus or minus one sigma of that average. So plus or minus one sigma encloses 70%. In the polls that we looked at a little while ago, if those are one sigma errors, what it says is if I make the measurement again, if I ask another set of people, I have a 30% probability that those numbers will shift by as much as whatever, 4 or 5%. That's why they were really a measurement that did. So one sigma, you have a pretty big probability of actually falling outside of one sigma from the central value. That's why if you make two different measurements and you want to know if they agree, if they are within one sigma of each other, then you say they basically agree very much. Because if you make the measurements again, you have a 30% probability that you even fall out of that. So they're in pretty good agreement. There's a 95% probability to find all of your measurements within plus or minus 2 sigma. and there's a 99.7% probability of finding all the measurements within 3 sigma. So if you want to say two measurements are discrepant, they really need to be at least 3 sigma apart. Because otherwise, you could just make the measurement again, and there's a non-trivial probability that just statistically you'll end up being that far out. Okay? But here, at 3 sigma, that statistic, that probability that you could ever measure something, that you could ever measure this same thing, same number, and fall this far out, now starts to be, 0.3%. That starts to be really small. In practice, in physics, if we want to talk about whether we discover the Higgs or something like that, we have to demand the 5 sigma excess. So, the number of times in the real world that people have gotten all excited about a 3 sigma signal and it only just went away after they published in the New York Times, and then goes away after they make another measurement, it's almost every time. It's really sort of ridiculous. Okay? Now, it's important to keep that in mind. The other thing about, maybe I have it here. So, if you ever see something, you actually want to know, is this crap or is it real? If this number were a 3 sigma number, then you're beginning to say something. Well, actually, for this one, you're not saying anything hardly anyway, because they're a low one. But if this is a 1 sigma number, look at this. If I just measure this again, this number could vary by 4%. There's a 30% probability that it would vary by as much as 4%, up to 45%, or down to 37%. Same for that one. So there's absolutely no power to distinguish these two numbers in this poll. Okay. The one thing to keep in mind is when you see these types of things, look to see how many sigma this is. Typically they'll put a 1 sigma number. Okay. But if they put a 3 sigma or something, you also will hear the words something is established at 95% confidence level. That means it's basically the 2 sigma boundary, right? At 99% confidence level, it's the 3 sigma boundary. At 68% confidence level, it's the 1 sigma boundary. So I don't know. And is that just here? Does it lingo? You hear that, right? Okay. Any questions? Yes.
The problem with four being a 1 sigma value on how you talk towards a 1 sigma value compared to a 2 sigma.
They have to tell you.
Oh, okay.
Whoever does the experiment. And if they don't tell you, I always assume it's a 1 sigma. Or if they say plus or minus, whatever, I assume 1 sigma.
Okay.
Okay, so now back to this sort of calculation. Sorry. When you calculate the standard deviation, you are measuring, in a sense, the width of this distribution, but the error that you get from the standard deviation is really what is the error on a single measurement. Right? Because the standard deviation basically gives you a sense of, if you make a measurement, how much you might scatter within that distribution. So that's sort of the error that you have on a single measurement. But if you have a whole series of measurements, right, sometimes you're high, sometimes you're low, so when you average them out, your average is going to be known better than any single measurement. It's sort of like the error's law settles a little bit. So, if you're really trying to make some observation, you make many, many measurements, you can calculate a standard deviation. That gives you how well you know any individual measurement. But if I then ask you, how well do you know the single thing that you're trying to measure, that you measure at the n times, you can use the information from all of your measurements which is then the average. And how well do you know the average? That's a different question than how well do I know a single measure. So how well do you know the average is given by this standard deviation, that is how well you know a single measurement, divided by the square root of n. And this turns out to be a really important formula in the sense that if you make a measurement that's statistically limited, and you then ask, how much work do I have to do to make that measurement 10 times more precise? If I want to make it 10 times better, I have to do 100 times more measurements. So if it's statistically limited, you can improve it by just doing more and more measurements, okay? But there's a limit to how practical that is. Things like graduate student lifetimes and stuff like that, you can only make so many measurements. So you sometimes will have to ask yourself, how many measurements do I really need to make of this thing that I'm doing in the lab? And one piece that's easy to calculate, if you've done a handful of these measurements and you have an idea of what your standard deviation is you can figure out what your statistical error is. And from that, if you are statistically limited, you can figure out how many more measurements you need to make to improve that number as best you can. But before you do all that work, think about your systematic errors, because if you find that you have a systematic error that is fairly large compared to this, why waste the time? That's the good side of having a systematic error. You can go figure out a systematic error. But, so, okay. Any questions? All right, so let's do a numerical example. Some say if Dante were alive now, he would describe hell in terms of taking a university course in physics. One vision brought to mind by some of the comments I've heard is that of the devil standing over the pit of hell, gleefully dropping innocent and hardworking students, as always, into the abyss in order to measure g, which is the acceleration of gravity. And so the devil then measures g by watching the acceleration of the students down into the pit of hell, and measures 9, 8.8, 9.1, 8.9, and 9.1 meters per second squared. So the question is, how well does the devil really know G? So you can get the average value of that acceleration due to gravity by averaging the numbers that the devil measured. Okay? So the best measurement that the devil gets is 9.0 meters per second squared. And then how well does the devil know it? You can calculate the standard deviation. So this is your average. So you look at the deviation from your average. You square them, you sum them, and you divide by n minus 1. So 5 measurements minus 1. So that means each measurement we know only to 1.2 meters per second squared. And you should always do a sanity check on that, because you should now look at your measurements, and they all ought to scatter sort of near that. Okay, this is 0.12, and these all vary within 0.1, at most 0.2. Statistically, what you know is that 3 times out of 10, you should have something that falls more than 1 sigma away. So I shouldn't be terribly bothered that I have an 8.8 here, which is more than the 1.12. Okay, it's all right to have one there. If I had 4 of them that were that far away, then I'd know I screwed something up, but this error is actually too small. So then, if I want to know how well I know this acceleration, I take the standard deviation, divide by the square root of 5, and I know, so my final report, the devil's report, is 9.00 plus or minus 0.05 meters per second squared. Okay? Are we having fun yet? Alright. Okay. Now, the problem that you often have is that you may be measuring something that depends on a lot of other quantities that you also have to measure. And so you take these other quantities that you measure, and you input those numbers into some formula, and you calculate what it is that you want. So one of the issues is that these other things that you measure, you also only measure imperfectly. So an error in one of these things feeds into the error of what you're trying to measure in the end. And we call the process of understanding how that error feeds into the final error, propagation of errors. And it's probably the single most painful aspect of your labs that you'll find. So, just to give you a sense, let's suppose that we've measured this quantity X, whatever it is, and we want to use it, calculate something else, which maybe we'll call Y, okay? And Y will have some functional dependence on X. So if I have an error in X that's like this, then that would feed into a lack of knowledge of Y that looks like this, okay? But if Y has a different functional dependence on X, say the slope is bigger, that same error in X may give a much larger error in Y. So how the error propagates from one variable to another depends on how they're functionally connected. All right, so we have to worry about that. Okay, so here are examples. Force is equal to mass times acceleration. So if you want to calculate a force, you need to actually measure the mass of something, you have to measure the acceleration of something, and how well you know these determines how well you know the force. So I would say that this is functionally dependent on these, right? The position, this is a formula that you guys will be using out the wazoo soon. The position of something depends on its initial position plus its initial velocity times the time plus 1/2 times acceleration times the time squared. And you see, it's a fairly complicated thing. And you have to measure time, you have to measure the acceleration, and it all fits in. But now this has a very different functional dependence, for example, than that. So whatever it is that you're trying to measure, you have to take all that, how it's mathematically related, and together as you're doing the analysis. So what I'm going to do is sort of say, we're going to measure something Y, and it will basically depend on all these other variables. In other words, there'll be some mathematical formula here that involves these other variables. And you will measure each of these things and use them to calculate Y. And the question is, how well do you know Y? So in order to do that, we actually have to look carefully at this function of dependence. But as you've already seen, this functional dependence can be very complicated. You can have multiple variables. Okay? So we're going to actually have to use partial derivatives. How many of you have actually seen partial derivatives before? Alright. So we're going to go through how one deals with partial derivatives. But a way to think about partial derivatives is sort of the following. For a derivative, and if you have some yx curve, right, so you have some curve, the derivative is the slope of that curve, right? Okay. Imagine that instead of a curve like that, we have a surface. So we not only have a dependent, so the height of the surface depends on where you are in both x and y. So it's a two-variable problem, right? So imagine that you're on that surface and you're standing on, you know, some little hill on that surface. Now you can ask things like, what is the slope in this direction or in that direction? The slope in X might be very different from the slope in Y, right? So the partial derivative is a way of calculating what the slope is in one of those directions or the other. So I can stand on this peak and I can calculate, I can look and I can say, okay, here's my slope in Y. But the thing to keep in mind is if I were to move over here, my slope in y has changed, and all I did is move in x. Right? So it's a little bit of a complicated thing in practice. So what you're trying to do is to, the partial derivative basically gives you the slope with respect to one of those variables when the other variable is fixed. So it's not a well-formed thing to ask or answer if I say, what is the slope in y? Because the slope in y will depend on where I am in x on this surface. So that's not a well-founded question. But if I say, for a given x, like right here, what is the slope in y? I can do it. Okay? So that's what the partial derivative is basically you look at the slope along this direction or that direction where the other variable is fixed. So that's the idea. It is, I think, conceptually harder than it is practically to just do. So the partial derivative, if I have some mathematical function, let's say it's a mathematical function that depends on x, y, and z, then the partial derivative of x, which notice you're used to these derivatives. When you signify a derivative, you use standard script D. Okay? The cool thing about doing partial derivatives is you get to use a much cooler symbol. It's this thing. Okay? So that is a derivative where you hold all the other variables constant and you treat them as constants when you take the derivative, even though they're variables. Okay? So the partial derivative of f with respect to x here is equal to the derivative of f with respect to x where I treat y and z as if they were constants. Right, remember, if I have the derivative of constant times x, I just pull the constant out, and the derivative of x is just 1. Right? So if I have a derivative of a partial derivative of x times y, I would just pull the y out and take the derivative of x. So I just treat it as if it's a constant. So we'll do examples. Okay? So let us specifically suppose, here's your formula. You know, here's your this function is x squared times y times z cubed. So the derivative, the partial derivative of f with respect to x is equal to the derivative of f with respect to x, so that's 2x. And then you treat these like constants, so you just pull them out. So you have the 2x times the y times the z cubed. That would be sort of the gradient in the x direction for a given y and z. But I could also ask, what is the gradient in the y direction for a given x and z? So the partial derivative of this function with respect to y is I take the derivative of this with respect to y, which is just 1, and then I pull the x squared and the z cubed out because they're constants. So that's the partial derivative of f with respect to y. And with respect to z, the derivative of z cubed is 3z squared. There's my 3z squared, and I pull the x squared and the y out as if they were constants. Okay? So you got that? So if you can do derivatives, you can do partial derivatives. All right? Okay, we will do that. Here's your formula. If we are trying to measure something which has a functional dependence on, say, these variables x, y, and z, and you measure x, y, and z, which means you have an error in x, an error in y, an error in z, this is how you calculate the error in that final quantity and how it depends on x, y, and z. Okay? This isn't as crazy as it may look. the error in the final thing that you measure is going to depend on how well you know the things that you put in to calculate. Therefore, you should expect on this side to have how well you know X, or how well you know your Y thing, or how well you know your Z thing, to be over there. Okay? So that's what this is. But now the thing is, if you remember, the degree of which any given variable you measure, like X, affects the final thing you measure depends on this functional dependence. It basically depends on the slope of that final function with respect to that variable. And that's what this is. So you take how well you know this variable and you weight it by the slope of the final thing you want to measure with respect to that variable. Okay? And then you do the same thing for all your other variables, and you add them in quadrant and take the square root. So they all contribute. But what this means, for example, is if you measure quantity X and you really know it very precisely, and you know that one very, very well, then this number is very small and it doesn't contribute much to the overall error. Okay? On the other hand, if it's huge compared to these others, it's dominant. Or you can have a case where they're all sort of contributing. But that's why you take your knowledge of how you know each piece that feeds into the final equation, and you weight it by basically the slope of that final relationship on that particular variable. And you sort of add those weighted contributions together in quadrature, and you take the square root, and that will give you the final, how well you know that final column. As you can imagine, sometimes this involves a lot of tedium. Okay, depending on what the equation is. There's a lot of calculations and getting derivatives and then adding and squaring it and doing the quadrature. It's really pretty painful sometimes. So it really behooves you to put some thought into things before you actually go through all that pain. So for example, look at the size of each of these individual contributions. Before you actually add equations up and take the square root of all that pain, maybe you can argue that this is 10 times smaller than either of those, so I'm just going to forget it. And you want to say what you're doing, but you want to keep your eyes on things like that. You may be able to simplify your life with a little bit of thought. Okay? Any questions on this? All right, so here's an example. Let's say we have a pitcher who throws a baseball, and the linesman laying out the field was drunk that day, so we only know the distance to half a meter, okay, to the batter's box. And let's say that we measure the speed of the baseball with a very bad sonar gun, so it's only, you know, 40 plus or minus 3 meters per second. So then, from these numbers, you know, what is the time of flight of the baseball? So the time, because velocity is distance over time, the time will be distance divided by the velocity. Those are the things you measure. In order to calculate the time, I would just take 30 and divide it by the 40. That'll give me the central value for t. And then the question is, how well do I know the time? And to get that, I now have to use the formula that we just had. Note that in this formula, there is a different functional dependence for d and v, which means the weighting terms, the slopes that I'm going to use in that formula are going to be different. So I calculate the partial derivative of this t, this function, with respect to d, and I just take the derivative with respect to v, and I pull out the 1 over v as a constant, so I get 1 over t. The derivative of this with respect to v is minus 1 over v squared, and d is a constant, so I get that. Okay, so here are your two two partial derivatives. And now you plug them in to that formula for sigma t, this is the final function. You take the partial derivative with respect to t, you square it, and you multiply it by the sigma. Partial derivative of t with respect to d. So this is the slope in the d direction with t fixed, with d fixed. Then you multiply it by how well you know d. Okay? And here you put the partial derivative of f with respect to v and how well you know v. You square these things, you add them to quadrature. So we knew the distance to within half a meter. We divide by v here, so that's what we get for this term. Multiply it by, that is the sigma v squared, is 0.5. Here, sigma v, we knew it to within 3 meters per second, and then this is the distance divided by v squared. Anyway, when you calculate this out, you get 0.58. So the final t is going to be d divided by v, which turned out to be 0.75, and the error in that is given by this formula, 0.058. So it is enormously painful, but science sort of is in a lot of ways, right? Because you have to make an observation, you have to be able to tell people what exactly it is that you saw, and you have to tell them exactly how well you know what it is that you measured, so that they can repeat it and understand how close they are to what you did. Or you can see if it agrees with your hypothesis or whatever it is. So the devil is sort of in the details. Okay, so this is possibly more relevant back in the old days, but very often you will see things where people lean over backwards to make a linear relationship. And in the day of calculators and computers, you may not really appreciate why lines are different from quadratics or anything else, because your computer can sort of do it all. And a lot of that really boils into the power of what you can just see when you look at it, really, is the simplicity of it. But I want to give you, I want to say a few things about linear relationships, and a lot of it extrapolates to more complex functions as well. But one of the reasons these are nice is because you can take a quick look at the data to see if it actually makes any sense or whether you have real problems. So, one of the things you'll often have to do is you'll have some hypothesis that gives you an expected relationship, and then you'll be wanting to look at the data and compare it to that relationship to see if your hypothesis makes any sense. So often you're looking at fits to the data, basically. How well did your curve go through the data? So here, for example, is this a good fit? What would you think? What you have here is you make certain measurements as a function of some other thing, so this could be, oxygen content as a function of some day after you put somebody on a drug or whatever. Do you think it's going to have a linear content? But these represent how well you make each measurement. Okay, so these blue lines represent the error in that. So would you consider this a good fit? It looks pretty good. You've got to expect some scatter, right? So if these represent one sigma errors, and you have a bunch of data points, you should expect a few data points to be more than one sigma away, because any given set of data points, you're going to have 30% of them be more than one sigma away, just statistically. So how about this? Not so much, right? What about this? This is also not so good, because this error is now small. So this is starting to be 3 sigma away. So in fact, if I saw this, I would say that's not a greater fit. That something that would be a better fit would be something more like this. The fact that this measurement is thought to be better, more precise, should pull the fit down. If you're doing a fit of a thing on a computer, it would actually pull the whole slope of that line down. Or another way to say it is, you might worry that the data is disagreeing with this relationship and looks pretty good for that relationship. Okay. So you got to pay attention to the errors on the data points. So you can sort of by eyeball or with graph paper or whatever do graphical analysis. You know, you can remember that slope is just rise over run, and you know, B is the y-intercept for the linear relationship. And then you can get a sense of your error in the slope by just looking at it, by literally sort of drawing lines where you go, you know, that's not going to be very good. The black one's better. The red one's not so good. So now I can actually measure the slope of the green and the red, and that gives me a rough error on the quantity of the slope that I have. So you can really sort of use your eyeballs to get a sense of how well things are established with linear relationships. Most of your calculators probably have ways to do linear regression. Very often you'll have a set of data and you'll want to find the best fit linear relationship or quadratic relationship or whatever. So very often you'll have data and you'll want to find a mathematical relationship that fits that data the best. And if we're doing lines, we call that linear regression. So the idea is, here's your set of data points. What is the slope and the y-intercept of the line that fits this data the best? Okay, very often you're wanting to figure that out. So the way that this works and what your calculator is actually doing, just bear in mind that if you don't look at the data and think about what your computer programs are telling you, you can get into trouble. If you press the wrong numbers going in, you'll never know if you're just in the habit of taking whatever number the calculator says. Same is true on all your physics exams, right? Look at the actual numbers and see if they make some sense. But let's suppose we have this set of data and we want to do a fit. So what your computer program basically does is it hypothesizes someone, and then you calculate how far that line is from each of these central values. So you have these deviations, and you sum those deviations up. Okay? So this is y, and this is mx plus b. So the mx plus b is this line, and this would be y. So at point I, at x sub I, this is y sub I, and this is m times x sub I plus b. So I can ask, what is this difference? And that's what I've drawn here. That's the y sub I minus mx plus b, where it's for the I x, okay? So that's what this quantity is. This represents this deviation, but it's for each of these in turn. And I square them and I sum them up. So this gives you an overall sum of all these deviations, if you will. And now, what you would like to do is to determine the slope and the y-intercept, that is the m and the b, that make these deviations the smallest globally. So the way you do that is you find the minimum, which remember from calculus, you find minimum by taking the derivative and setting it equal to 0. So you take the derivative of this with respect to m and set it equal to 0. You take the derivative with respect to b and you set it equal to 0. Unfortunately, you can't use straight derivatives because you now have the two variables, so you have to use partial derivatives. And if you solve these equations simultaneously, you get the M and the B that are the best fit bodies. That's what your computers do. So you can do it analytically in certain cases. Your computer might do a search phase. So it may start out by hypothesizing an M and a B and calculating this quantity, and then changing M and B in certain directions and calculating again and seeing if it got smaller or bigger. If it got smaller, it continues moving in that direction. So there are algorithms for computers actually do a search phase to try to find the right parameter. And this kind of thing is not infallible, so you really always do have to pay some attention as to what kinds of numbers are coming out and see whether it makes any sense. You can take it one step further to do this right, but I'm not going to bother with you. You can input the error of each of these things. So, for example, this best fit will get pulled by points that know that have better measurements. So you can input the errors in a lot of these programs and things. So again, draw the best fit line out and look and make sure there's bias toward the points that you think are really well known. And if it's not, then you're probably doing something wrong. Any questions on that? Any questions on any of this? So I think that's all I've got.
Unless told otherwise, yeah, but some professors may not want you to use calculators.
Well, in your course.
In my course, I don't care.
Okay. Will the problem be designed for calculators, or you can use them?
Well, yes, they're designed, you will want your calculator.
Okay.